Sorry, no surprise. So the forum will begin today with our usual welcome to folks who are with us in the office. And Tricia, please have us run us through a safety briefing. Thanks.
Good morning. Welcome to the Natural Resources Building. Please silence any noise-making devices you have. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor, cover your head as best as you can, or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In any evacuation of the building, staff will lead you out the doors in the front of the room, then the first door on the left, moving towards the parking lot along Washington Street. DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to emergencies. Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia. Our first item of business is approval of minutes from the February meeting. There were some edits, I think, from the initial version that was sent out that are reflected in the version that's in your binder for today, or in your packet for today. Are there any other comments on those? Any other additions to the minutes? Clarifications for the minutes? Hearing Mr.
I had a question on the first page of the minutes. On 43, there's a sentence that I don't know if I'm misreading. But it says the legislature is fully aware of the success of the road maintenance and abandonment planning in increasing fish passage barriers.
Yeah, that's a little counterproductive to the objective of the program. I think in repairing or addressing fish passage barriers is probably a substitution we want to make.
Is that not amended?
It is.
What was amended?
Got it. Okay. Well, okay. I guess both David and I are working off an older version. Sorry about that.
Sorry.
But good catch. Thanks. Any other clarifications on the minutes? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
Move to approve.
Second.
Motion's been moved and seconded. You catch them. Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Say no. Abstentions? Thank you very much. We open the meeting with a general public comment period. For those of you who are new to Forest Practices Board, the general public comment period is for general board topics. Public comment on specific action items that are later on the agenda is to be reserved for those. So this is a general comment period. And you have about 3 minutes for your comments. Keep an eye on Patricia for the signs on how you're doing with time. I believe the first is Bruce Barnes. I apologize if I didn't read the handwriting correctly.
Good morning, Chair and the Forest Practice Commission. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak here. My name is Bruce Barnes. I live at 4101 Northeast 50th Avenue in Vancouver, Washington. And the reason I'm here today, I've handed out some literature here. Basically, I want to hand this this stuff here around so each member can view this. A little bit about myself is I'm a 27-year electrician for IBW Local 48. I sit on the Southwest Washington Labor Council. I'm an executive board member for the Elect Workers Union. I'm a graduate of Washington State University. And I know everybody on this board also stands for higher education. And the reason I'm here is to voice a complaint to your committee, and I understand that you guys have got a lot of stuff on your plate here with the landslide, and I appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak here today. What I'm here to speak about is the forest practices in our state to do with the chemical use in our clear cuts. I've basically exhausted myself with our state lawmakers, our different agencies, Department of Ecology, Fish and Wildlife, Department of Agriculture. I understand that these uses of the chemicals that are in the forest are listed for a use on the label. But when they're mixing these chemicals in a cocktail, it shows no use in what the effects are. And what I'm concerned about is our Southwest Washington elk herd. And on one Timberlands property, one Timberland owner since 2006 have had an alarming amount of elk not only dying, but dying of hoof rot. And I think that it's either an indirect or direct fact that these animals are dying because of these chemicals, in my opinion. And the reason I say that is when I started to do my research really and dig into this thing a year and a half ago, it led me down a rabbit hole of information by your Forest Practice Board here. And one of the things that was alarming to me is there was no permit fee for the timber companies for applying for these permits. Another alarming thing was to me to find out some of the chemicals that were being sprayed on the clear cuts. I'm an avid elk hunter and I hunt in these clear cuts and I also consume this meat. And when I see that they're spraying atrazine, when they're spraying Velpar, DL, DH, and some of these other things, I'm asking for this Forest Practice Board to actually take a good long investigation of what's being sprayed here, because some of these chemicals aren't to be grazed on for 60 to 90 days after application and up to a year. So when you're spraying this in a wildlife area, there's no fences. These animals are coming into this area and they're consuming all these dangerous chemicals. And they're not only dangerous to humans, but they're dangerous to the fish and wildlife. And when you look at the University of Alberta's study that they just got done with, the lady that did that study couldn't even find a clear cut that hadn't been sprayed in the Mount St. Helens region where I live. Also, the USGS service has just conducted a survey of the Columbia River where all these drainages have got these chemicals coming down the drainages into the Columbia River. So these chemicals know no bounds. And the worst part is a health and safety issue, is all these chemicals are going into our water sources where everybody's drinking from. So I would urge this board to look into this. And the second thing in there is about the access into timberlands. I would like you to look at the tax situation there, because now they're charging folks to get on their property. And they're blocking us out of state and federal lands by doing this and charging a fee to get on those lands. So I'll be brief, and I appreciate it, and I hope the board gets back to me. And we'll be back up here next August. Thank you for your time.
Max Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Smith. I reside at 14,000 Spirit Lake Highway in Tootle, Washington. And I appreciate the opportunity to address the Forest Practice Board. I'm going to read my statement. Over the past year, acting with private citizens, we've researched concerns about habitat changes that are playing a role in the outbreak of hoof disease. We discovered the following concerns regarding aerial herbicide spraying and the permit process. We are not making any claim that current herbicide spraying is a direct cause of hoof disease. However, recent independent and department studies show a decrease in valuable native habitat for all species from its use. During our investigation, we discovered the following concerns related to herbicide sprays. Aerial spraying permits are given in large unit sizes, some even up to 7,000 acres in size and good for 3-year periods. While the industry name chemical is listed, there does not appear to be any information regarding the amounts that are used in this time frame. In most, every permit we received on an average showed 3 chemicals that were being mixed into what they refer to as a cocktail, with no MSDs sheets on that mixture, but only for the individual chemicals. In most every, with over 1,100 permits being issued in the Pacific Coast region over the last 10 years, we did not see any that triggered a Class 4 SEPA review. Is that possible, since we do have wetlands in that area and a 7,000-acre permit? Just a question. These permits are issued by DNR staff, in some cases requiring several days and even weeks to review and approval. Yet, there is no cost for the application. We want to know why. It appears that the public comments are accepted on these permits. The question is, where is the public comment posted so we know where the permits are and what they're for? And if there is public comment, where is that kept so we can see it for review? We couldn't find that anywhere. According to the application of Forest Chemicals Guidance for Application, Part 3, which is the state document for putting chemicals on the ground in a forest, pesticide records should be maintained by the landowner in compliance with WAC 16228190. I serve on my planning commission in Cowlitz County. The word should is not mandatory. The word should does not have compliance and enforcement. It means should. We'd like to see that change. 9. If the above question is true, how are the Forest Practice Board, you, in compliance with the federal regulations like the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, or the CWA, which is the Clean Water Act? There does not appear to be any oversight following up or testing to ensure that all parts of the permit process is being implemented. We're approving chemicals whose MSD sheets have conditions used on grazing lands stating that cattle should not be allowed on these areas for 60 days to 1 year. However, we are applying these chemicals on forest land with wildlife that graze within hours. While they are approved for controlled agriculture, should they be used on timberlands? The current process appears to be lacking accountability, oversight, and enforcement. To ensure habitat for fish and game, health, and public safety of our residents living, working, and recreation in our areas that is being applied. I want to make it clear, I'm not here today to shut down our forest production or to bring hardship to an area that's already regulated. I'm here to point out the concerns and the observations that are identified. We will therefore hopefully warrant a review by you to see this policy. With today's public awareness and concerns with the use of pesticides and chemicals on our environment, we feel that it's important any agency who permits their use to be held accountable and be able to defend the public, their needs, and safety. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. Apologize that I ran over, and I did give you reference on this to all of the reports that we are referring to, which are the herbicide reports, and Mount St. Helens conditions, Mount St. Helens elk population conditions, and the recent Columbia River study that was done by USGS that shows chemicals in the Columbia River. Thank you for your time.
Gene Crocker.
Good morning. I'm Gene Crocker. I live in Castle Rock, Washington, and I'm a native, as you might say, because I was born and raised in Riderwood. Riderwood was a unique place. It was put in there by Longville Lumber Company, and I was there when they logged all that southwest Washington country. When I was a young fellow and I hunted that area, you could go in a canyon, you'd be 40 deer in this canyon and 40 in the next. They'd all be different deer. The last 2 days of deer season was doe season. We had a very high population of black-tailed deer. My question is, where have they gone? I spent 21 years in the Navy, came back, started hunting that same area, and the depletion of animals are so great that I just sat down with my son and I said, what are they doing today they didn't do 50 years ago? The land went from Longbell Lumber Company to Fiber to International Paper and back to Weyerhaeuser. Then I found out, started looking at the plot of land in southwest Washington, the Weyerhaeuser would cut a little square, and when they got through logging it, they would spray it. They'd spray it with a herbicide that kills everything for 4 years. Then they plant trees in there. They plant them so close together, in 7 years, there's no light from the sun to get to the ground. So there's no food source for the animals to live there. We lost all the pigeons. We lost all the native grouse. We have lost a lot of honeybees. I've had six hives myself that have died off, and I've attributed all to herbicide sprays coming back and kill them. They say mites and the herbicides are killing them. You can look at all the advertisements and things about bees being killed lately, and they find out that herbicides, by golly, have done the same thing. And then there's another place I can take you and show you that Longbell logged this steep hillside and let Mother Nature do her thing, and that was let the seeds naturally come back and protect the land. And this whole hillside that in 2006 slid into Stillman Canyon caused a large flood in the Chehalis River country down along the Boisford was all attributed to the fact that they sprayed that hillside with a herbicide, so Mother Nature didn't have the chance to grow these little plants and would hold that dirt there. Long come Mother Nature with a heavy rainfall, and guess what? Whole hillside slid in. And I can show you places in the South Tule, up on Green River, and the same thing has happened. They spray the hillside, all of a sudden they get a heavy rain, the hillside runs down, the whole hillside pushes the roads out, and they close down these through traffic. I've been telling people for 20 years that this herbicide is bad, and maybe somebody's going to finally listen to us, and hopefully that you guys can change the policy. When Longbell logged their country, they left seed patches on the hillside. Mother Nature did their thing. We had a variety of trees that came back. Now they want to plant that hillside with sterile trees that don't produce any seeds, so the critters that lived and lived off those seeds don't exist. The deer don't exist there either. They've had to move down to find some vegetation that they can survive on. Why they're going to charge to hunt this area, I wouldn't even buy a hunt license if I was the most guys that wanted to apply for the hunting in that area, because there's very few animals. I guess I said enough. Thank you.
Okay, we're picking up on some of our discussion from yesterday, and this is to help us out a little bit of continuity in the application review discussion that we had to close the day. I thought it was important that the board hear from the head of our course practice geology science team, and so we're going to have Leslie Lingley come up and join us talk, finish up the discussion about application review. We'll then get into our public comment and action items from yesterday's discussion.
I'm quickly answering a question and we'll get in and get out. I believe Bill Little asked the question, board member Little asked the question regarding class 4 specials and the number of large versus small forest landowners. There were, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Sorry. There were a lot of questions yesterday. So for small forest landowners from January 1, 2013 through December 31st, 2013, there were 9 small forest landowners and 74 large forest landowners. That's it. Thank you.
My name is Leslie Lingley, and I'm the Forest Practices Science Team lead. We have normally 6 geologists in our team. We just lost somebody resigned, so we have an open position, and that announcement should go out next week to try to get another licensed engineering geologist. Let's see. Okay, we do have over 100 years of unstable slopes experience in the field. We had like 140, but one guy left and the other person went up to set lands. But we still have about 100 years of experience in unstable slopes in the forest environment. All of us have to be a licensed engineering geologist because we review geotechnical reports that the landowners provide for us. So we couldn't have a, we had to be able to review their FPAs. We also have different roles. I'll show these for you, but we also, we are the consultants to the forest practices foresters in the region and to the district managers, and we are consultants. We do not make the decisions on the ground. We recommend and suggest for the forester how to make the FPA finalized. But if we are the people that make the decisions, we are it's a conflict of interest. So we are the consultants to the regions. We also participate on ID, interdisciplinary team members. We conduct geologic studies if we need to. We work on and off for CBER. And can I say that? Okay. So Isabel Saracan, who heard from yesterday, she has opted to be the UPSAG chair, and she's got a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of good ideas for UPSAG coming up. So So that's really a good deal. We haven't had UPSAG meetings since about 2 years. So she came from geology, and I also stole another person from geology to come to Forest Practices, and his name is Trevor Contreras, and he's our new addition. We also do wetlands, unstable slopes training, and CMZ training, channel migration zone training. And we've been doing these trainings since 2002. And in each one of those classes, we have trained over 500 people since 2002 till now. We do two trainings every year on each one of those topics. So we normally want to have all the Forest Practices foresters, and they come back, you know, every time they have, we have open slots. We also have the geotech, the qualified experts will come to our trainings to make sure that they're using our board manual and making sure that they always ask, answer all the CEPA questions.
Can we turn it all off and start in? This is where
it's... Can you take a minute while we get the technology figured out?
Well, I can talk about some stuff if you want.
Here we go. Got it.
Okay. What happened? Okay. So, what
Carol is
going to do. Okay, so this, yeah, magic. All right. Okay, this is a team. Okay. I've already told you about training, unstable slopes, blah, blah, blah. And we also provide expert testimony for appeals and enforcement actions. We do not have the regulatory authority to do enforcement issues. So that's why we are the consultants. We may often have to take an FPA three or four times in our hands because we will get a geotechnical report. And if we need more information, or we have been walking the ground and found another rural identified landform, and they would have to amend their geotechnical report. And that normally only happens when we're doing it FPAs that are around 100 or 200 acres, because it's really, that's a lot of ground to go to. And even though we are screening tools once in a while, we'll find something, but it's pretty rare that we find something that the geotechnical experts have not found. So today, I just want to quickly go through the rural identified landforms and how we review our FPAs. This is, you've all seen that yesterday, so we're going to go very fast. I'm going to go through the test.
Sorry.
I'm just going to read this, and you can see some pictures. Timber harvest or construction of roads, landings, gravel pits, rock quarries, or spoil disposal areas on potentially unstable slopes or landforms that has potential to deliver the sediment or debris to public resources, or that has the potential to threat public safety, and which has been field verified by the department, we have to go out on the ground and look at these. So we normally go with a forester, and we are still always licensed engineering geologists. What's a public resource? Public resources are water quality, fish and wildlife habitat, and capital improvements of the state or its political subdivisions. What does the potential to threaten public safety mean? It is to increase the risk to the public at large from landslides or debris torrents caused or triggered by forest practices, and the other part of that is or snow avalanches identified in consultation with the Department of Transportation or local governments. Now, we're going to go through some of the rural identified landforms relevant to instability. And it is any landform that is steep and concentrates water. When I used to work with engineers, they always said there's only three things that contribute to landslides, and it's water, water, and water. So, and we also look at deep-seated landslides. These are the rural-identified landforms. The three A's are all greater than 70%. The toes of deep-seated landslides are greater than 65%. And we saw this, you can read this again, I'm not going to go over it. But E is, we always call it E, and that's why I did the ABCD. It's any other area containing features indicating the presence of potential slope stability, which cumulatively indicate the presence of unstable slopes. So that would be the biggest rural identified landform that we have. So I want to show you some pictures of bedrock hollows, and I would love anybody to want to come. If anybody wants to go out in an FPA on the ground, I can facilitate that almost any day, because we almost have one every day around the state. So I would happily like to take anybody out if you want. So bedrock hollows is a term that is also known as hollows, swales, steep gullies, spoon-shaped areas, and convergent topography. This is what they look like on the ground when they've been buffered out. And we measure these on the steepest part of the slope, not the axis, because it's not normally 70%. They're always steep and convergent. Now, intergorges have their own definition, and they are canyons created by a combination of the downcutting action of a stream and mass movement on the slope wall. And so when we get out there, we're looking for exposed soils. We're looking for a U-shape topography, which indicates that there's been deep debris flows through there in the past. So the slopes here are 70%, and they have to have a gradient. Break in slope is where they usually bound out the inner gorge. It's high likelihood of delivery, and normally they're deeper than 10 feet. We don't say we have an inner gorge if it's 2 feet incision of a stream, except if, well, never mind. So we have hillside intergorges and we have valley intergorges. And so, so these are 10 feet deep. These are way deeper than 10 feet, but all of them are greater than 70%. And now you can see the difference in the gradient where you could start delineating the inner gorge. And this is a picture of what inner gorges and hollows look out in up the Acme area and Sigatowits streams. When I was in Oregon presenting this at a forest practices meeting, the people around me were just going crazy to see how much we buffer in Washington compared to Oregon. And we had a lot of conversations about that. So convergent headwalls are teardrop-shaped landforms brought at the ridge top and terminating where headwaters converge into a single channel. They are broadly convergent and are contain bedrock hollows with very steep ridges in between. And these are greater than 70% slopes. I already said that, but. And this is what a convergent headwall looks like when we've bounded it out. If you have a gigantic one of convergent headwalls, once in a while, you may be able to harvest the sharp ridges in between, but that's maybe 2%. And the vast majority of the landslides that we see in the forest from these rural-identified landforms are rapid slides, debris flows, debris torrents, and those are just difference in the amount of water that is constituted in those landslides, in those flows. And we also have the outer edges of meander bend here, and they are the outer edges remove the buttressing effects of the slope and create the failures to deliver to sediment and debris to many streams and rivers. And the toes of the deep-seated landslides with slopes greater than 65% are normally in, those toes are in rivers. And so we want to buffer those if they're not contained in the RMZ. So I'm just going to show you parts of a deep-seated landslide. This is a rotational landslide, and we look at these sort of indicators to determine if we are on a deep-seated landslide. There are other characteristics for translational landslides, but you have to have a number of indicators to be able to be sure that you are that, you're on that landform. And our definition for a deep-seated landslide is landslides in which most of the area of the slide, plain or slope zone, lies below the maximum rooting depth of forest trees depths of tens to hundreds of feet. So that's the difference between a shallow rapid landslide or a deep-seated landslide. And we have groundwater recharge areas of glacial deep-seated landslides. And this would be the groundwater recharge. And our rule, and here, and this is a common site all through Puget Sound where there is permeable materials above less permeable materials, and those are part of the definition of our deep-seated landslides and glacial sediments. And on this one, the houses on this bluff, they are on the groundwater recharge. And we have, this is what this looks like on an air photo in Northwest Deer Creek. And we've delineated this deep-seated landslide. And we look at the landslide like right here, and to try to find groundwater recharge area, we put arrows perpendicular to the topography, and any arrow that goes next to this deep-seated landslide would be the upgradient area of the deep-seated landslide. And because we have no subsurface information, we do it by topography.
Can I ask so go back to that. Just to be clear, so the gray dotted area is what you would be calling the groundwater recharge area for that particular.
And groundwater recharge is also on the body of the landslide. Uh-huh. So this would be the upgradient of this, the water that would be delivering to this landslide. Yeah, but when you look on this one, this is a LIDAR image at the same with these two landslides, and you can really see the headscarp benches, more headscarps. You can see bulbous edges over here, and then on this one, that's where we would have put the groundwater recharge through the topography.
Can I ask a question as well? Did you want to go?
Right.
Okay. So do you feel like, you know, given that kind of situation, you know, what you're saying is that you don't necessarily always, or maybe in many instances, have the information about the underlying soil characteristics, but
right.
Using that topography, I mean, do you feel like you essentially draw a precautionary line based on your best judgment using topography?
Absolutely, and especially on a topography that is derived by LIDAR, it's really pretty awesome, because in the past, before we had LIDAR, we would be looking at 10 or 30 digital elevation models from air photos. And the resolution there would be so much gray than we would have now in LIDAR. So you can pretty much see that if you were doing the arrow thing here, this guy here, it's going down that way. And these, you have arrows here going here. I'm trying to get that thing back. Let's see. Okay. So I've talked to many geotechnical, the qualified experts, and usually the topography mimics the water flow. If you know subsurface stratigraphy, it may be different, and the groundwater recharge area may be larger or smaller. It depends on what you're doing. If you can see, if you can see some stratigraphy, but you would have to have enough to understand that if this looks like glacial outwash or something, but if you had large areas of stratigraphy that you can see the layers of the sand and the impermeable layer, you may be able to know that it's dipping into the hill or down in the hill. But most of the time, with this vegetation we have in western Washington, you don't get a lot of outcrops to look at. So the only thing you can do is bore, but you'd have to do a lot of borings to know exactly what the stratigraphy is. One boring would not help, because you wouldn't, you'd have to have at least three, right? So you can say the elevation of that layer is flat, and if it's, you've got three of like this, you'll see that it may be slanting in or out of the slope. So.
On the other side, where it kind of has worked up to the ridge, how do you draw the groundwater return zone?
This one here?
Yeah.
Well, you would still take these. If you look at this, you would have a perpendicular arrow here and here, but you look at this, if these are going to go this way, this might be the full extent of that groundwater recharge. It could be that, just the deep-seated landslide. It depends.
So it might just be that one.
Yeah, it could be this part here. But going here, everything's going into this stream here, and everything's going into this stream. We probably had a little bit here. So it's pretty complicated, and you have to do you have to look at the topography and put hundreds of those little arrows so that you don't miss a little part of that topography.
So were there other mitigating techniques? There's other things besides the groundwater recharge area that might be present. I guess what I'm looking for is when you're dealing with a deep-seated slide area like this, are there other things that you would do?
Yeah, and when you go into these deep-seated landslides, all of those characteristics that I showed you, we have levels of activity on these deep-seated landslides. If this is a landslide that has not moved for 10,000 years, all of those characteristics are muted, and you wouldn't see a big difference between a scarp and a bench because it would been eroded, would have been eroded in the past. And if you don't have any sag pounds and you don't have rotated blocks with root, trees coming back toward looking at you, you would say that this. It's not an it's not an active deep-seated landslide, and so the activity of the landslide also comes into play as it's dormant or it's relic, it's really really old or it's not moved in. It's got all those trees are perfectly straight and it doesn't have indicators that there's been any movement. We don't have any pistol gutted trees or kinky trees where you have the land moves and the trees grow out to the front, sort of a different direction, and then they'll go up again, and then you'll see another kink and another. You know that landslide is still active. So we look at all those indicators when we go out and look at a deep-seated landslide. And in the board manual, it says, looking at an active deep-seated landslide, but that's just guidance, and we would not just put that on the shelf and say that if it's not an active deep-seated landslide, it doesn't mean that we still wouldn't do some work on it and assess it as well as we could. So you need to know what the landslide's activity level too, in order to, and then look at the groundwater recharge. Anything else?
I have another question for you.
Okay, let's get this. Okay. So, when we look at the areas that anything else could look like, have other indicators. So we look at, you can see some tension cracks. You'll see wet vegetation stripes of deciduous trees, seeps in wet grounds on steep ground. The lack of old growth stumps is another indicator that if they've gone down the hill, something's happened. And so these are our well-identified landforms: Inner Gorge, Bedrock Hollows, convergent headwalls, toes of deep-seated landslides, outside edges of land beds, and springs and other indicators. So everybody talked about screening tools yesterday, but now you can see how well we can identify some of these rule-identified landforms. This surely is a convergent headwall. This is probably one too. And we look at all of these really steep inner gorges, and we have bedrock hollows all over the place here. So when we are looking at a really good LIDAR image, and say we have a FPA right here, we could get a lat long on each one of these little areas and go right to it and then see and measure it. Is it rule identified? Is it 60% or is it 70 and greater? So then we would go down and do that. And just to let you know that these red polygons are the, we did a report on the ACME after the 2009 storm, and we just used the LIDAR to show where all the landslides we found from air photos. And then we have the slope stab, which is based on curvature and gradient. And you can see when we use slope stab, we have to have an accumulation of a lot of pixels. As you can see, we would never be able to go out and look at every single pixel. And so that's pretty over arching. But you can also see that this is a convergent headwall, and some of these were those bedrock hollows. So this would probably be our first screening tool, but we have better ones. And then from the mass wasting, with the watershed analysis, we have all these mass wasting map units. And so like the purple one is convergent headwalls like that. And these are bedrock hollows. And they're all mapped as a specific mass wasting map unit, and we still use these as screening tools. And then we also have landslide inventories. As we said yesterday, we've got like 61,000, I can't remember, landslides in our inventory. And I'm so sorry. We can identify those, and we have a level of certainty on the landslides. They're definite, probable, or questionable. And none of those, we know if this is probable, we probably go out and look at it.
Leslie?
Yeah.
Back on that slide.
Uh-huh.
So tell me about the completeness of the inventory and the data that are available to feed into the inventory. How thorough do we think it is?
Well, we've got 52 watershed analyses that all the inventories in there, and all the 59 landslide hazard zonation landslide inventories. And then there's all the landslides that were on geologic maps that were Dave Norman showed you yesterday. They're QLSs, it's Quaternary Landslide Deposits. So that gives you an idea that there's a landslide there. Do you want any more?
Yeah, there's quite a bit.
Oh, from reconnaissance.
We did a lot of reconnaissance.
Yeah.
To stuff that we collected in the field.
Yeah.
So DNR collected recon, or?
DNR geology did.
Yeah. I can speak to that, because I created and maintained the Landsite database for quite a while, and still participate in it. So DNR has, after the 2007 storm event, we did a reconnaissance of a series of air flights, field review, to collect as much landslide information as we could directly after the event, since landslide data is perishable. And also after the January 2009 storm event, we also collected through a series of flights and ground verification through those storms as well. And most even small-scale storms that come through the area, this is through the Division of Geology and Earth Resources, would go out and either try to find a, being a location for those landslides to be entered into the landslide database. But the completeness of it is you'll never probably get every landslide mapped in the whole basin. There's projects that continue to go on through the landslide database. Is essentially any large data set that we've found in the state has gone into it. So there's probably about 20 different publications and other works throughout the state that have been integrated into it. But there's, you know, still areas that lack. Eastern Washington probably lacks significantly, both in the study and the amount of data. Western Washington, because of its larger population areas and more emphasis on where landslides occurred and studies that have occurred, has a more complete data set for that area. But certainly in areas that we have LIDAR, are probably most heavily mapped, and where the data sets, at least for deep sea landslides, are more complete. But areas that lack LIDAR and areas could be lacking areas of where those deep sea landslides and or shallow landslides exist.
What did you pick up during an FDA review?
We have not put that in the, it's one of those things that we don't have enough GIS people to
I think the question that was being asked is not have we compiled FPA information,
yeah.
Right.
Moving ahead on application by application review,
yeah.
In the absence of an inventory, the site review would reveal, obviously, the landforms.
Yeah. And on this one here also, this has got the geologic map behind this, and you can see the different kinds of layers. There's sedimentary in here, and then there's the salt, and we look at things like faults that are on the maps, because faults usually they could be a starting point for unstable slopes.
Maybe it's more of a, so you said there are GIS constraints on essentially going back and digitizing previously approved FPAs and want to then identify after those previously approved FPAs. Well, right. What has the department or division looked at that? How much time and energy would that take?
We've actually discussed it with our GIS folks, and if we have time, like in the winter, we could go back through at least all the geotechnical reports, because we know that those were stamped by a qualified expert. Mm-hmm. So you can take those landslides and put them into our database. And we've got lots of projects like that we'd love to do. And that would be a really good benefit for screening tools, too.
Sort of backward looking.
Right. And then we have all the...
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay. I just kind of wanted to follow up on this line of questioning. So in areas where you don't have LIDAR and you don't and no work has been done to sort of inventory landslides, and I'm especially thinking of the glacial deep-seated ones, so you don't have the ability to sort of as precisely define the boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
is what you were saying is that still when you go out in the field, though, that you can see all the indicators on the ground, so even if you don't have LIDAR, you feel confident in being able to draw the boundaries?
Absolutely. Yeah, we can. And we do simple things like not going on contour if we think we normally go up and down, and you're going from the top to the bottom. You really see the differences in the slope pattern. And if you're going down a really steep slope and then you have a bench and then you go another steep slope and a bench right there, you think you're going to have to identify this as a deep-seated landslide and then look at all the other indicators to see if you have these sag ponds or the rope, the side marginal streams and things that we use to identify a deep-seated landslide. We can still find them and delineate in the field.
Maybe I want to add one more thing. So for a lot of this too, I think to bear in mind the landslide database and LIDAR and all that stuff is for remote review to help us prepare for the field. And certainly with the absence of LIDAR, through air photos and DEMs, we can usually still get a general idea that a deep-sea landslide is quite still in the landscape. The delineation in the field, probably even over LIDAR, is probably still far greater for us than anything that we might see on LIDAR or through remote sensing.
Another question about this in areas of the presence of recent evidence of landslides in an area where you have, and we saw on the LIDAR yesterday, the Stilley area, had a lot of, in my view, kind of unusual type of activity. You have a bench of material that's laid down plus kind of flat on the top.
Right.
And then the sides, over time, capped off. And would you, and it wasn't too recent, how would you process that kind of detection that we saw on LIDAR? It's not really recent, it's not really.
You would still go and look at the, like I said, if it's a very old deep-seated landslide, some of the characteristics are muted from corrosion, just regular erosion from water and some of the steep slopes. So I think when you're talking about the one that the USGS guy said that it was a B and not an A, you can actually see that there's no more indicators that it's moving. If all those trees are certainly straight and it's 1,500 years old, and there's you saw one of the pictures of one of the stumps that was split on the probably on a Humvee area, you would see that that's still moving. And I don't think very many people actually looked at the, if it's not well, it's easy to look at on a air photo 3D, stereoscope, sometimes you miss those too. So that's why we walk them.
Just to clarify, so geologically, what's old? Because I think geologists regard that term in a little bit different way than maybe the rest of us do.
So when you talk about glacial years, we're talking generally about continental glaciation, which kind of ended, depending on where you are in Washington, 10 to 12,000 years ago. We had. Essentially, the way to kind of think about this when we think of deep-sea landslides and we talk about different ages and stuff, when the glaciers retreated, we had a lot of rivers and stuff that came in size into the area. And as you can imagine, the glaciers probably held up a lot of areas When those got removed, that removed buttress support, the rapid defined by the rivers removed buttressing support for a lot of areas. So after the glaciers removed, we had a lot of deep sea landslides that would have formed within that environment. After that 10, 12,000 years ago, when we have a series of landslides fail, a portion of those landslides that we would call relic at that point, because it was just the removal of the deep sea or the glacier or the current incision of the rivers, that all the other actions of why that landslide failed and why that land mass became unstable stabilized on the environment. And then from that point on, we had a series of landslides that continued to be active through either climatic processes or other processes that we would need to identify. So in a historic sense of deep sea landslides on the landscape, that's kind of like when we talk about different ages of landslides in a glacial environment where we have that 10, 12,000 year period, because glaciers came in, completely obliterated the landscape, reshaped it, and then retreated. So I hope that helps to clarify that.
I think it's maybe the question is around how do you evaluate an inactive feature, right? How do you evaluate the potential for reactivation?
Or a landscape in that case that has shown similar activity in the past. I mean, we had a recent slide that was very similar to the ancient, the older one. And so that whole landform there, to me, says it's still active. There's probably, you know, future you could expect that it might happen again. I'm just wondering how we treat that, because it's not really, you know, a lot of that area isn't, if you look at it right now, you could drive through it. Say it was unstable, but you look at the LIDAR and you see, look at this whole huge feature here, a terrace of deposits that over time we have off, and it's happened over 1,000 years or more, 10,000 years. And so to me, it's a bit of a unique feature. Maybe it's not as unique as I think it is, but it's not active in the 10 or 20 year time frame. It's active in the 1,000 or 2,000
well,
time frame.
You would look at all the indicators in the morphology within this landslide, and we're not looking at if there's been any movement in there in the last couple hundred years, you would probably still see it. So we're talking way back, 500 or 1,000 years. Go ahead. It's just.
So yesterday, Jonathan got, when he was talking about the landslides, like in the Oso area, used the term relative age. Mm-hmm. And that relative age essentially is a morphological expression on the landscape. So we live in a very wet environment over here on the west side of Washington State. We have a lot of climatic weather with rain that erodes the landscape or kind of weathers the landscape over time, the geomorphology. So a landslide that kind of has semi-recent activity, even in the last 1,000 years, still is kind of sharp on the landscape, and especially on LIDAR. So those indicators for us, with trained eyes that have seen this for years and years and years, is very apparent to us versus a landslide that we've seen move 10,000 years ago and has undergone 10,000 years of essentially rainfall and erosion on the landscape. So within those, kind of on a remote viewing sort of sense, that's how we would remotely review it. And by the time we get into the field, we find those kind of observations based on what we see in the field and analyze the morphology as we got out there as well.
Other questions before we move along?
Okay.
We run you over time a little bit.
Then we have the landslide hazard zonation maps that have hazard ratings, and these hazard ratings are the study itself has protocols that you can compare a hazard rating to another hazard rating in among those 59 projects. So we look at we look at areas like this, and it will be like steep slopes on tertiary volcanics, and we would be looking at that. It always, it says it's already steep slopes, so we have an FPA here. We're going to go out and look at where those polygons are. And we also, that. And then the other great tool we have here in this office is the 3D photogrammetric imagery, and they use orthophotos. And I'm just using a Google Earth to show a 3D imagery, but we can look at 3D on 2011-2013 ortho photos, and so we also can use this before we go out, and you can, and we can determine areas where we see instability that you couldn't see on an just a regular ortho. So these are the things that we've done for looking in the field, but we still have to go to every one of these FPAs that have unstable slopes on them. We go to every single one on class 4 specials. We go to every one that anybody provides a letter or a semi-qualified expert report on threes that they're telling us that they're not harvesting on any of those, and we go out on those. And the other ones we go on are the ones that the foresters come out and they don't have a letter, they don't have a geotech report, but they see something and they walk, they have to walk the whole unit because they're looking at everything like from murrelets to NP streams. So they see a lot more than we would do in an initial walkthrough. And then they call us and say, well, I see something that I don't understand what it is. And you have to come out and show it to us. And so that's what we do. And so we do consult with the DOT when harvest is may affect state highways. And if the FPAs are in the urban rural interface, we look at ecology's well logs to get some stratigraphy. Not great all the time, but and there's always, each one of the science team resides in a region, and they really know all the geologic studies in their regions, and they use all of that information, and the geologic portal is great. And we also have a SharePoint site that we document every single one of our FPA reviews, and we can do a myriad of statistics on how many landowners, how many FPAs the foresters had, and we also look at how many acres we look at and how many feet of road we look at. So we have a really good database of how we do our FPAs. So anybody else have any other questions? Yes, Tom?
Thanks for the presentation. On the hazard zonation study, you mentioned this hazard rating. I know we haven't completed the study, but in terms of what we look at for that hazard rating, are we looking at the runout potential from a landslide, or just the landslide? So.
No, we're not. We're not gathering data on runout potential.
With the order, geotech report is not required, right? Because the delivery potential needs to be evaluated in the geotech report.
Yes. Yeah.
So it is in that case. So. Right. But not. But in our study, in the hazard
information
study,
LHC, we don't have that.
And then I guess, would you want to talk about the available resources to calculate runout and the things that need to go into those broadly?
There's not one.
Okay, let's go.
Okay, so there's there's a handful of studies for shale landslides that do help us calculate landslide runoff for shale landslides. There was actually a fairly complete study by Lee Bunda that started for landslide runoff for debris flows from forest fires that was essentially we took it, and it's progressed through time through different more iterations and calculations. We've taken that runout model to compared it out to debris flows that we've mapped. This is when I did a study on this when I was in the Division of Geology and Earth Resources. When I came up to forest practices, I started implementing this into my reviews and everything to look at potential runout through this model. So there are models that exist. Not as much data exists for runout models when it comes to deep sea landslides, because deep sea landslide movement in large extents is a much more rare occurrence. So the amount of data collected on that, especially when it comes to Washington State, is fairly rare and hard to come by, even throughout the world. That runout model, there's not a lot of data that exists for runout models for deep sea landslides within the literature. So kind of give your take on which side you want to go on. But for shallow landslides, there is a fair bit of development and assessment within that.
Could you talk about the relationship of forest practices to shallow rapid and DC to a bit, just explaining the relationship?
How many, like, deep
sea root structure, or what you look for, how do trees contribute to stabilization?
That's why we bound these things out, because we want to make sure that we retain as much root strength around an area that we think is going to be potentially unstable. So we bound these features, knowing that that root strength is helping prevent those debris flows or debris torrents. However, we also know that those well-identified landforms were defined through all of the watershed analyses, because we found that they always fail in a certain area where it's convergent and 70%. And so is that probably not?
Then with deep-seated, what do you look at?
And what do we look at
as far as forest practices?
Well, we look at the recharge for glacial deep-seated landslides. However, you can, it depends on the size of a deep-seated landslide. If you have a 10-acre deep-seated landslide, putting a road across the body is probably not going to have any effects, as long as you don't put water in certain areas. And there are deep-seated landslide complexes that are so big that you probably wouldn't, a 40-acre harvest would not affect it. This is not in glacial deposits.
It's just indicators.
Morphological
age.
And also, when we were doing watershed analysis and trying to determine if we had a deep-seated landslide, we would look at high elevation topography, because then you can see more of the indicators. Sometimes you can see the scarps and benches and all that. And when we were trying to determine if we had a deep-seated landslide, I always have to have at least three or four indicators before I wanted to make sure that I was going to say that was a deep-seated landslide. And almost all of the people doing watershed analysis would do, we had to do out and validate our landslide inventory, and the deep-seated landslides were the ones that we went to look at because you could see debris flowing. We didn't have to verify a debris torrent or a debris flow or a debris avalanche. But if you were looking at the indicators on an air photo, we would go out and look at that one and make sure that it was a deep-seated landslide. And those are the ones that are probably definite. And the ones that go probably were not field verified. So we have to just, in the deep-seated landslides, you have to go look at it. Now, if we have LIDAR everywhere and in each region, I can tell you that we would probably be able to define deep-seated landslides, and then we would know exactly to go where to look at them, because they're very easily identified on LIDAR. Because you can see all the indicators.
Okay, we're
done.
We're running behind a little bit here, so we need to get caught up.
Well, then they don't have to ask us later. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so the next segment of the agenda is around action items, both in terms of adaptive management, work priorities, recognizing that whatever the board may wish to do around an adaptive management, part of our responsibilities also involves the other work priorities we've assigned, policy and CMR, and then a second segment on non-adaptive management related work priorities. So I'm going to ask Stephen and Adrian and Jim to come join us as soon as we complete the public comment period. Karen Willard.
I thought you were ignoring me.
Good morning, Chair Everett and members of Forest Practices Board. My name is Karen Williger. I'm with the Washington Forest Protection Association, and I just wanted to speak for a few minutes this morning about the priorities for the TFW Policy Committee, talk a little bit about what we've done in the past and maybe a little bit for the future. And you're going to hear a lot from Stephen and Adrian, but I just wanted to preface it. First, I wanted to say also that I appreciate DNR and the board's indulgence in going through this two-day period looking at mass wasting issues. It's been very educational. We had a similar set of workshops and policy, learned a lot, and put together the recommendations that you saw in front of you. I also wanted to say, just on a personal note, that my heart and prayers go out to the Oso victims. Folks that were here yesterday were very, very expressive in their testimony. And although the investigation, the science is not finished yet, and there's no evidence yet that logging contributed to this Oso deep-seated landslide, I think in the wake of a tragedy like this, it is really important and very prudent to take a look at the policies and procedures that you have in place. And so with that, I know that you'll be looking at the mass wasting recommendations that policy forwarded to you in February. And I think that's an excellent framework for how you go forward in looking at the next steps on this issue. If you recall, there are several pieces to that. First off is a policy review of the process itself, looking at the process, much like you did yesterday, looking at the flow charts of how a forest practices application is put together, and also looking at the forms. DNR most recently on Friday issued a new form that would give more information both to the public and to DNR in terms of what is happening on a forest practices application. We also talked quite a bit about LIDAR, and I think that Isabella and Leslie went through a very exhaustive review with you this morning about how efficient that tool is, but it's not the only tool out there. And the strength, I think, in our forest practices application process is that it is a site-by-site specific process of review. And we went through this review process with DNR pretty extensively. And one thing that's really important to note is that there's a lot of redundancy in the process. So when an individual forest practices application comes in, the application is complete. or it goes back to the landowner to get more information. And then as that FPA goes through the process, it sometimes gets up to 6 reviews. You have a review by the forester in the company where they do an office review and they also walk that land. You do a review potentially by the geologist in the company, a qualified expert, both an office review and a field review. Same thing happens at DNR with the forester and the geologist. ID teams oftentimes are called to look at these specific issues. And now as of Friday for some of these, there may even be a geotech report that's required. All of this in terms of trying to put together the best information possible for the public and for DNR. And for landowners, it's really important because our number one opportunity is to avoid the impacts. Thank you. And so just one more thing, you'll be looking at the research strategy as well. I just wanted to call your attention this afternoon to a decision you're going to make, which is to put potentially $50,000 into the beginnings of a strategy for deep-seated glacial landslides. Thank you.
Jim, Adrian, and Steven, please come join us.
I'm going to lead off this morning. For the record, my name is Adrian Miller. I'm the manager of policy environment with Olympic Resource Management, and in this capacity serve as co-chair of the TFW policy. Similar to yesterday, we've got a set of sort of our talking points to kind of help us stay on track and hopefully help you with your note taking. It's also important for us to try to accurately reflect kind of the range of opinions and ideas that were communicated in policy. You know, a lot of times when we provide a report to the board, it's at the end of a full process, and we have pretty exhaustive review in terms of what our specific recommendations are. This is a little bit less defined, as you might imagine, and thus the format is a little bit different than perhaps you've seen from us in the past. So with that introduction, yesterday we kind of talked in general terms. We're now going to dive into some of the specifics. And there's sort of one bureaucratic step that I think we need to raise, and that is, you know, up until this point, TFW policy had been focusing on water typing as our primary work priority. That doesn't mean the world stopped and we didn't do anything else. However, that certainly took the lion's share of our time. As you contemplate some of the options that Stephen's going to present here in a little bit, I want the board to be cognizant that, you know, we would seek, you know, if the board decided to change policy's priorities, we would seek some formal action to do so since our existing priority was set by the board. One other small bit of information that I think is important to mention, since this also sort of serves as our update to the board in terms of what policy has been working on. CEMER, from time to time, as you well know, completes a project and brings out the policy, and we have to make a decision on whether or not to recommend any actions to the board. And there was at our last policy meeting, there was a study of the bull trout overlay temperature shade report. And in recognizing, we got a good briefing on the study. I think the general consensus was that no matter which way you might felt on resource protection of the resources evaluated in that study, the risks were generally pretty low. And so recognizing that we've got a lot on our plate, policy actually made the consensus decision to manage our own workload a little bit and defer any action on that particular item until we kind of get a better sense of our priorities and work through some of our more pressing workload. But I didn't want to lose track that did arrive at our doorstep. So with that, Stephen's got some, he's going to talk about some of the, some options for the board to consider as they think about policy's priorities in the context of our existing workload and potential additional pieces. And then I'm going to go through some of the considerations primarily of sort of looking at, you know, the sort of pros and cons, I guess I would say, of making some changes to our workload. And so hopefully by the end of this, you'll have gotten a sense of kind of the range of opinions on some of these decisions that you, my guess is you'll be working on this afternoon and this morning.
Thank you, Adrian. For the record, I'm Stephen Bernab from the Department of Ecology, and I'm here in capacity of the co-chair of TFW policy. So the two things we have in the notes in front of you that we would like you to consider when you're giving us direction today. First, just completing, as we indicated a couple of times yesterday in the mass wasting effectiveness study, some of the recommendations coming out of that was reviewing DNR's process around unstable slopes. And we suggest that you have us complete that review, including with the board manual, the new form that's come out, and report back to you with any concerns or recommendations that we may have at the August meeting. The second thing that the board chair actually requested us to do, and we're more than willing to raise this in priority, is to take a good look at our mass wasting research strategy. That was also contained in our recommendations to you in the February board meeting. Because of the event in March, we probably, or in the absence of the event in March, we probably would have just done this as an ongoing item, probably in the afternoon of policy meetings. But recognizing there's some urgency, we're more than willing to take that into account and work as hard as we can to at least give you a preliminary idea of what we might a look at that research strategy in August, but probably not have a complete review of the research strategy until the November meeting.
So can I just stop in?
Yes.
Let me understand and the board members understand a little better what all is involved in reviewing the strategy, what needs to be involved in that conversation, how the length of time that it will take. I know you've got an estimate of reporting in August and complete by November, but help me understand. Is that because of the process itself and who all needs to be involved in the conversation, or is that because we've got other work priorities that we've assigned to you that we've not reassigned in priority? Tell me about that.
Yes, good question. Both are true. One is we need to consult with CEMER as we do this. CEMER has already, just as Mark did with you, took us through with the existing strategy. Now we need to buckle down, actually go through each of the projects one by one, determine whether they're still relevant or not, figure out whether some need to be raised in priority as a result of current events, that kind of thing. And then we need to put and think about, okay, priority, dollar value, what kind of effort it's going to take, what kind of resources, people resources we're going to need to kick those, move those forward. And so that does take time, but like we said, we would like to at least give you a preliminary view of what that would look like in August and a final review in November. The other piece is, yes, there are other things that we're going to be doing for you. What you haven't heard, and which Jim will tell you about more this afternoon in his report on the CEMER budget and the CEMER master schedule, is that we are going to be asking the board to direct us to take a more full look at the CEMER master schedule before the August meeting. For two reasons. One is we want to make sure that when we go to the legislature this next session that we're as close to being on target as to what the priorities for the program are and what those dollar values look over the long term, not just over the short term. And to do that, we're going to have to do some more work than what we had done recently. And so we look at that as a competing but complementary priority between now and August that must get done without a doubt. And so our goal would be to take the mass wasting strategy that may change in priority, or some projects may come up in priority, and make sure that portion of the mass wasting strategy gets looked at first in the context of the senior master schedule by the August meeting. And then the rest of the strategy would be looked at after that. So that, hopefully that answers.
If I could add just one piece that I think is pretty important to recognize, and it was implied by Stephen, but I want to make it explicit, is that, you know, right now we have, you know, we always work concurrently with a number of items, but we have a focus priority, and that has been water typing. The time frames that we described to you would mean we would take a break for that period of time, and that would not be as high a focus. And so we'd essentially be looking at a bit of a trade-off between those two subjects. That doesn't imply the world stops, but it does imply a redirection of resources. And so I think that's important to make explicit.
So tell me if this is not the right time to ask this question after I ask it, but what I'm trying to understand is, there was some presentation by Mark Hicks yesterday about the specific studies related to glacial deep-seated landslides and groundwater recharge zones, and so I imagine that the review that you would be doing on the master schedule and prioritization and when those studies would be done would be part of what you'd be talking to us about in August.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, digging a little deeper then, so right now there's a presumption that the groundwater recharge areas are sensitive. I mean, they're class 4 trigger. That's correct, right? If you have a groundwater recharge zone associated with glacial deep-seated landslide, and you know that you know where to draw that line, that kicks it into class 4 special. Correct.
What's the question?
So I'm trying to like lead you down the path of so we're already presuming that these areas are not good to log on. So can you talk about how these studies that are proposed sort of refine our understanding of is it understanding of where you draw the line? Is it an understanding of whether or not you can actually do any forest practices in those areas? So I'm trying to get a sense of you know, given current practices today, given what we know, given how we draw the lines about where to log and where you probably shouldn't log, how do the studies that are in the master schedule help us refine that understanding and either draw a better line or make different decisions about where harvest practices should and shouldn't happen?
So I'm gonna go real high level here. A lot of the there's a lot of projects in the work plan that were I'm going to say brainstormed 10, 13 years ago. Part of what we need to do is basically start over, and this is maybe one of them, is start over and do a complete look, and I'm going to call it scoping. Do a complete scoping of, in this case, one of the rural groups, an important role group at this point, and ask, you know, just start over and basically, are these even the appropriate projects? Or should it be other projects? What didn't we know 13 years ago? What do we know now? In other words, what part of that gap has been filled? And then what is it that we still don't know that we should know? What is that gap? And basically look at possibly completely turning that role group on its head. Unfortunately, we don't know that until we go through the scoping process. And so that's what the purpose is. So we'll be looking not only at what research has been done, not only by CEMER, but by others, and what hasn't been done, but we'll be bringing in the science to give talks. This is the process that we went through with the Type N strategy. And eventually also look at Schedule L1. Do we have the appropriate performance targets, resource objectives. If not, then there'll be proposals before the board on changing those as well. So it's really a pretty thorough review of the strategy.
And so
difficult to make to answer specific questions about what is or will be done or change.
As Mark said yesterday, you know, the last time the Glacial Deep Sea Rural Group was looked at was 2006, and there's been technology changes, and hopefully we'll learn more about science to inform us on what to recommend to you. But this is also an opportunity for the board to direct us on areas of investigation you're interested in and think we should explore when we're reviewing the mass wasting strategy.
Of the current projects in the strategy, I mean, are any of them at a stage where they could be initiated at any immediate point in time?
So the unstable slope criteria, I have a memo ready to be sent out to three individuals to start that project, depending upon what happens this afternoon. So the unstable slope criteria that came out of the mass wasting project, where we had, I want to use 40%, I may be wrong, but 47% of the slides were outside RILs, outside rural identified areas. That's the purpose of that project, is to look at that.
And that's in keeping with policy recommendations, but doesn't have anything to do with Glacial Deep Sea Rural Slides.
Right, correct.
Correct, and we have no projects ready to go in that group.
Okay. So,
in the program.
So then, yeah. You know, from strategy revision completion, whether that's August, November, whatever it is, I mean, at the soonest point in time that the board is going to see any new science around the Unstable Slopes Rule Group that pertains any way to Glacial Deep Sea Landslide is going to be 5 years.
So that we really can't answer that until we actually go through the exercise of looking at that particular rule group. What we think we can commit to today is completing that first pass and reporting back where we're at with hopefully a little bit more definitive answer to these kinds of questions at the August meeting. And we think we can do that specifically for the glacial deep-seated pieces of the work plan, and then more to come on the other kinds of features. And I think that's, in terms of the time horizon, that's the most I would be comfortable committing to, not knowing what the results of that dialogue are going to be.
Okay. Well, I mean, given time frame for the strategy revision, then, I think is, as far as work products, is so far out in terms of new studies and the completion of the studies that I don't see an issue with your recommendation of kind of a check-in in August and a full decision on it in November. Is just sort of irrelevant to the concept of a new study in the immediate future. Is there a board discussion around that particular time frame? I mean, we're talking about the long-term science strategy component of this here, and that's just going to be a while, it seems to me. Paul?
So I think given that, the question is, are there things that can be done? You know, this is, I think, maybe a question for us, and you guys listen to it and think about it, but is there something that we can or need to direct policy to do in the meantime prior to those studies being scoped, those studies being initiated, that can actually, improve the likelihood of a public safety outcome, given what we don't know, right? That's so you've essentially helped us frame the question that it's going to be a long time before we get more, actual science, and we'll hear more about that later. But in the meantime, given that there are uncertainties for the lack of the science, what do we do? And is there something we should do?
So as we get into the presentation a little bit more, I think there are some opportunities to address exactly that. And I think that, so, you know, if we want, we can certainly continue this dialogue iteratively. I'm perfectly happy to do that, but we can go through it. Pleasure.
Go right ahead. I'll flush it off.
So we're going to kind of skip ahead in light of that, because that's where the dialogue obviously wants to go. I just point out there is a summary of kind of, you know, information you've heard now, I think, three times in terms of the regulatory process and the research strategy that's under TFW policy discussion points that are things that were raised in our conversation that you've heard in spades over the last 2 days. So happy to go back and answer questions on that later. But I'm moving over to the considerations piece. And in specific to sort of board member Swedeen's comments, I try to bucket these things out into what kinds of things policy can do. And policy has already set up a process by which we're going to be looking at the procedural steps and reviews. I think one thing substantive we can do, and it would be consistent with that, is add public safety to that part of that review. And so in our, you know, the recommendations Stephen talked about, certainly coming back to looking at DNR's process, which was daylighted and discussed in great detail, we were already going to be looking at that under the context of the public resources. Simply adding public safety to that review is certainly something we can and would be happy to do. You know, that leads into things like the form changes and all of those other other projects. So broadly, those are some substantive things that can be done. Looking at board manual processes and all that. So there's a process step that we could certainly do, and Stephen's indicated, you know, we'd be able to, again, report back on the results of that discussion with any recommendations, certainly by the August meeting. So that kind of ticked off a couple of the bullet points at the beginning of the list.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, Tom. So this is I'm not sure how easy it'll be to come back to some of these things. Sounds very good. I was going to ask a question about public safety, and I was able to read ahead in your memo, and you talk about it a lot. I think that's a key thing that we need feedback on as to whether that or how that can make a difference in our processes. Mm-hmm. So I'm very glad to see you focus on that. Related to that is what we heard yesterday from several people is this public notification that folks were looking for in some way. I don't know how that can play into the process, but I would like that considered as well by policy. Is there an action, or is there a part of the process where the public can be better informed, either of hazards or just enforced practices within sensitive areas?
So on our last page, above type F update, there's it's the second to last filled in bullet, and this is really more in the context. It doesn't quite get at the notification piece, but it talks about, you know, when you talk about integrating public safety, there are things that sync up very well and are appropriate with forest practices. Public safety also, as you're aware, has a much broader connotation and you know, requires, I think, a broader conversation in terms of risk. Forest practices is one piece of that puzzle, but there are certainly several others. And so to put a fine point on it, and I will come back to the notification piece here, if a landowner happens to own an unstable area that's a threat to public safety and never harvests anywhere near it, completely avoids it, doesn't impact that at all, there's still a risk. You know, a landslide could still happen.
Right.
And that piece, you know, if we just rely on forest practices as the sole tool of managing that, then that's going to miss those things. So in the context of notification, yes, I think there's certainly a role for that. I would suggest that be part of that broader conversation around, you know, where forest practices, the department, I would say Department of Transportation, who else did I list here, certainly county land use, you know, folks that aren't usually part of our regular forest and fish policy sort of resource protection groups, I think it's a slightly different sort of context. Are we part of that conversation? We being the Forest Practices Board, we being all the stakeholders around that board? Absolutely. But we're not the only place that that conversation could happen. So certainly we could talk about notification and how that might work in our forest practice system. But again, we might be missing probably the greater risk, frankly, of folks outside of forest practices.
It's an awkward conversation because we've got a lot of topics and we get a four-page memo. And so if we're jumping to things that we've covered here, I apologize.
This works.
I just wanted to echo that it's, you know, extremely clear to us, the counties, that we have to address the issue of notification and providing information that crosses our boundaries from what the county manages and what others manage, whether it's the DNR or private landowners or whatever. So I very much encourage that. Maybe we're going to have to do a little thinking about how to set that forum up, that I think it's critical that that happen. And so I support that. In terms of the research, also in the, but actually, the review of the process, and it's a very complex and it's a thorough process. I guess the question that I'm still struggling with that I'd like policy to talk about is how decisions actually get made during that review process. And what are the criteria, particularly in the context right now of public safety. We heard yesterday that in certain situations, we're not too concerned because there's no delivery to public resources. In some places there's delivery to public resources, but maybe not public safety issues. And so I think we have to talk a little bit about when we go through this review process, the final decisions that get made about what happens and what doesn't, what the mitigation is, what's not. Those decision criteria need to be discussed. And that's really the crux of it, of the issue. Yesterday, we were talking about the three points of questioning about unstable landforms, and the first one was, will this cause movement? You know, to me, I'm saying, well, we know we can't really say something causes something. We know it increases risk or not. And in some cases, we can sort of quantify that level of increased risk. In some cases, we can't. But so we have to get a little bit finer edge on our decision-making criteria and how we're making decisions. And so that needs to be blended in here. I'm not sure how or where.
So, considerations, is that synonymous with recommendations?
I wouldn't say so, simply because we didn't have time to come to a full consensus in our process, and I would be at great peril to express this as a consensus document. So the compromise was to provide a suite of ideas. That's not to say we can't come to consensus. I don't want to imply that. It's simply that we haven't had the discussion at that level of detail. I think what we're looking at here are all pieces of the kinds of conversation items that we would have to have resolution on as we work through this process if we went down it. And there are some choices in terms of how narrow or how broadly. And certainly, we can take board member comment and certainly reflect it back. You know, I believe that you know, if we were to implement a review of our process and explicitly look at public safety, if that was the direction the board gave, then we certainly would look at how decisions get made. And we would look for places where, wow, we've got good process for public resources, but maybe we don't have what we need for public safety and bring back more specific recommendations for how to do that as a hypothetical. It may be that we arrive at shortcomings on both sort of delivery points, if you will, and be able to bring that. So I think we can do that work. What we'd be looking for is A, is this our priority? B, in terms of the process, are we indeed going to look at public safety as opposed to simply public resources? And then we can talk also about, that's sort of the short term, and then we can also talk about sort of the how the research strategy does integrate with public safety, which at times I think it does. And then I think there's other elements as we've been sort of talking around this notification concept where the research strategy may be part of a broader conversation. And I don't feel like we've really gelled on a solid answer for that last piece, and perhaps something that's we could refine a bit and bring back if that was the board's direction.
So we're going to need to work toward toward our action items here, and as far as your direction on priorities. It's already a recommendation of policies as far as the mass wasting report information to have a look at street screening tool and LIDAR. So we just kind of set that aside as something that's not completely within our control, although I'm going to come back to that in a minute. As far as the process description and additional documentation requirements, those are obviously things that we've just heard are ongoing, and policy ought to, I think, follow through on its earlier recommendations to complete those reviews. We can direct you to do that again if you like.
It's simply a prioritization. I mean, so
yep. So we'll need to work through a motion around direction on balancing the priorities out. Among, for example, the type F work and type N work and all of the other work that is in the adaptive management daily work. And then I think we ought to begin the process of reviewing the strategy that's part and parcel, it seems to me, of the overall master schedule development, but specifically we need to have a look at what the research questions are that pertain to public safety. In a way that's unique from sort of the broad public resource considerations that have been part of the strategy to this point. So those are follow-on to things that have already been discussed in policy. We can incorporate those in motion. Additional recommendations around the rules themselves, specifically the Class 4 Special triggers and the language around the content of geotechnical reports and the department's decision-making process once an application hits Class 4 Special Trigger as far as the specificity and decision-making process, I think are and ought to be within the scope of the process review.
Would agree.
So, board member discussion around those types of adaptive management-oriented action items moving forward, does that go to a list of near-term things that can be produced in the program? Again, setting aside the fact we got to reorder the priorities as far as what all the balls are that we need to have. And I know we've let's just come right to the question of do we want a policy to undertake a proposal from the board to look at OMAE specifically of some kind. We've had discussions and suggestions from folks about a moratorium-oriented type of rulemaking. There are others among the, for board members, the Class 4 Special Rules and Rule Identified Landforms are asterisk rules, meaning that it's compulsory for any changes to those rules to go through the application process. There are a number of different ways we could try and skin policies, look at what to examine in that rule set. But I want to just air the question of the moratorium specifically, allow us to discuss it before we finalize direction of policy and move ahead from there.
Maybe I'll start. I've been giving this a lot of thought, not only the last couple of days, but the last 2 months at Snohomish County, we've had a similar discussion, and we're considering, we started talking about a moratorium within a certain distance of our erosion hazard areas, and we defined it very differently. It's a 33% slope. We kind of did a map of the county and did some buffers that would have covered the OSO situations. It turns out the whole county would been off limits. So we have, again, 33% slope. So we're currently looking at increasing setbacks from urban hazard areas where we allow building. And if there's a deviation opposed to that, you want to get into it, then we get into the geotech report. So that's kind of what we're doing. And I think a lot of this has to do, we've got a great process here, and we've got a lot of very dedicated people, and a lot of science has been done in the States. On, you know, just kudos to everybody for where we've been. We know we still have some gaps. We know we have some uncertainties. I hope we'll take a fresh look at the mass wasting studies that have been proposed, and we have to go forward on those. We know we have uncertainties about how forest practice influences the groundwater recharge areas, and how we define those areas is critically important pieces and have to be done. In the interim, from my standpoint, we know that we have some places on the landscape that are really the highest risk type of areas. And in particular, when we look at public safety, it's clear to me anyway that areas of groundwater recharge or mass wasting areas are one of those places that, you know, we probably shouldn't be right at this point in time until we have better information. So I sort of reached the conclusion that a prohibition of some sort in those recharge areas near documented UCD landslides and glacial areas that can affect public safety or impact public safety should be off limits while we sort this out. I know there's some debate about whether or not the board can do that. And the Forest Practice Board has some different authorities than we have at the counties. And so I'm not a lawyer, so I don't understand all the nuances there. But I would like to have that conversation, that are there some places that we can just back off, and while we're sorting through these scientific technical issues. And I feel there are, and I'd ask the policy and the board to take that into consideration.
And you made reference to, you know, whether the idea of a moratorium itself is within the legal authorities of the board. And I think there is a considerable amount of question about that. The board's authorities are founded in statute. Statute refers to the forest and fish report, and the forest and fish report approach to one stable slopes in particular is pretty explicit, and it revolves around the system that we have with application classing, which, as the board promulgated its rules following forest and fish report, in the case of, again, these class 4 special applications where the department is trying to make a determination around the significance of the activity and the mitigation measures that are required to either determine that it's not significant in terms of its likely impact on UCD landslides in this case, or its determination of significance of what all needs to be mitigated if that determination is made. But the board's direction in rule is very explicit, actually. It says, if you're going to make a determination of significance, you need to have that decision mitigated in such a way that it avoids impacts. And I know that that's not a moratorium, and I understand the distinction that people are trying to make with that. But in light of the fact that I'm not certain that is legal for the board to do, I think it's well advised for us to secure some formal advice from the Attorney General's office in the form of a published AG opinion. And I just don't want the board to act outside its lawful capacity. And I think it's valuable against whatever direction we give to policy as far as what to consider and how to consider it to allow ourselves and policy and the public to have that conversation armed with the knowledge about what is actually within the decision space of this board specific to the issue of the moratorium. And so I'm prepared, although as I understand it, the board itself as an entity can't actually request an official Attorney General opinion. I'm prepared to, on behalf of the commissioner, make that request because it is something the statewide elected official can do in the capacity of chair of the board. And so I feel like we need to answer that question
feel like that's valuable to the public debate. And I'll just say to all of you right now that that's what I intend to do around that question.
Do you have any idea how long that would take?
I can get you a memo as soon as I've had a conversation with the agent. And, you know, the board's obligations here are to perform the review of what's going on in our process and understand, you know, the certainty of our decision space. And that's got a lot of moving pieces to it, obviously. There are science questions that are going to take a long time to answer, if, as the folks from USGS told us, they can be answered at all. And so where we're operating right here is in a space where we've got some near-term measures that are directly within the control of the board. We've got some longer-term process review that needs to take place through the adaptive management process, again, staying within our authorities. And then as we get to the next series of actions, we've got some things that are exclusively within the purview of the board or the department that we would think about.
So I have questions and I guess thoughts, maybe a little bit more specifically around you know, some interim actions, either short of a moratorium or in the forms of questions that we can post to policy to look into for us. And so, you know, based on the presentations that we've heard over the last couple days, there's a sense that in the absence of LIDAR, we may not be able to as accurately define the boundaries of glacial deep-seated landslides, but on the ground, it's easy to tell. However, there might be situations in which people aren't directed to the ground spots. Right? In the absence of the best screening tools, we may not be able to even say, hey guys, go out and look at this. And so that's a question I pose. I mean, is that a gap? I mean, I couldn't quite tell from what was being told, I mean, what was being presented to us. But I have this sense that there may be an opportunity for an unintentional gap out there because our screening tools aren't quite as good as we would like them to be. So that would be one question to pose to policy is, you know, come back and answer that question for us. You know, is the current system fail-safe in terms of knowing where glacial deep-seated landslides are? And then the second source of uncertainty is where do you draw the line around the groundwater recharge zone? And, you know, we heard a very informative presentation from the geology staff today about the way they use topography and how they draw the line. And it sounds like if there's precautionary areas, they can do it. But it sounded like there was all still, and I heard the statement, they might be bigger or smaller if when we use topography. So, you know, is there a way to draw some sort of line that says, okay, this is where we think it is, but in order to be safe, we might want to go back a little bit from that. And so those would be the things we do in the meantime prior to more research being done. And if that was all consolidated into one, you know, say publicly accessible, forest practice forester accessible, geologist accessible, GIS layer, say, you know, here's where we think the glacial deep-seated landslides are, this is where we think the glacial or the groundwater recharge zones would be, where this is how you find them. And then if an FPA falls within that line, one idea would be you either kick it automatically into Class 4 Special, and so you just know that all the studies are going to be done, so you take the closer look, you know, or there's some more preliminary step. But that would be the one approach for policy to consider in that process review and tell us, do you think it's needed? Would that close existing gaps? Would that address public safety issues, you know, in the nearer term until, you know, better tools can be, better screening tools can be developed and this longer term science can be done?
And if I could just offer some clarification on that specific unstable slopes, direction-related treatment of how groundwater recharge areas are defined as far as geotechnical reports and as far as the interpretation of the rules. That's in board manual. So our technical supplement to the rules, board manual 16, has a discussion of how to delineate groundwater recharge.
recharge areas. And as we talked about yesterday, between the existing unstable slopes rule group strategy component around the Ewing board manual for contemporary scientific knowledge about how to make these delineations, it occurred to me that it's related to adaptive management's work, and I would expect a stakeholder process around the discussion of the board manual, but it doesn't have to be an adaptive management task, because if you recall, the board manual itself is DNR's, or sorry, is the board's. Where you have board manual that pertains to sort of asterisk rules, you undergo this stakeholder process where there's a need to update those things. But I think what we could be looking for maybe in our next non-adaptive management set of action items is to direct board staff to convene a science group with consultation with stakeholders around board manual direction, make sure it's contemporary. And that process perhaps informs the policy dialogue around the rest of the issues that they're asking us to, or whatever we might ask them to look at. But it doesn't, it's in somewhat independent of that management at the same time, so the process is quicker, one hopes. For staff, roughly characterized. So we've got a number of items on the table.
I'm sorry. Paul, you were suggesting a direction, and you had clarified. I was just looking back at Paul to see if that sounded consistent with both.
Well, yes, and better if it can go through board manual development process then, more quickly than formal adaptive management.
So why don't we, let's just take a couple minutes and see if we can get staff to get a set of things on paper in the form of a draft proposal. We'll come back together and review that, so we don't have to do it all on the fly. So let's give ourselves a 15-minute break.